The spirit in you enlivens the spirit in me.
Unity is the singularity of two or more things coming together as one thing. Now that's kind of a brief description of what unity is in one sense. In another sense, the unity that I'm referring to in my book, I'm talking about the unity that we experience with each other, the unity with our relationship with the world and its parts. And then lastly, the unity that we have or we can have with God itself. Our connection to everyone and everything and God points us to a greater truth about our soul. And knowing our soul changes that experience. And it opens up the whole topic of unity, because unity is not really so much a concept, but rather an experience that we have when we're in direct relationship with our soul.
And it's also mentioned, too, that we unconsciously seek to find our own likeness in others. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I think that we unconsciously seek to find like-minded people. So when you first meet somebody, we start to assess, how are they like me? Mm-hmm. And then if we start to see common ground, then, okay, well, then we think that they understand me more. You know, if we've gone through similar life experiences or we have similar interests, then we start to find common ground. And from that place, we start to make friendships and create deeper connections.
Why do you think it's so important for people to feel understood?
That's a good question. I think part of that is acceptance. I think the reason why people need to feel understood and have a common ground is to feel acceptance, you know, to claim your position or part in amongst the crowd of the oceans of people and places and things, you know, claiming your position.
It says that we unconsciously seek to find our own likeness in others. And I do 100% agree with that we don't dwell on the fact that people may be somewhat like us. You know, I think you just kind of connect and you just say, oh, I really enjoyed hanging out with them. Maybe there were similar hobbies or something like that, but I think it goes a little bit deeper than that in how you feel like a connection with someone. Mm-hmm. And that part is difficult to define. I think when we connect with strangers or people we've never met before, you meet a new friend at a party or something like that, there's just people that we tend to gravitate towards even before anything is said. I've noticed that.
And what happens in a lot of my upsets that I've had in the past with people is that I'm upset because I thought I knew the person. Mm. Or I'm upset because I thought the person was like me. And so I unconsciously was trying to fit them to almost be me in a sense. And when they couldn't fit the mold which I projected onto them out of sheer need for the world to agree with me or to like my ideas and thoughts and expressions, then I became disenchanted with somebody. And when we realize that we're unconsciously seeking ourselves through other people, we then start to realize, you know, maybe that's it. What we're looking for is the soul in another.
Hmm.
And not so much the personality, likes, dislikes, but we're looking because the truth of the depths of who we are is that you and I are both souls, and that there's no distance between my soul and yours. And that's the grounds of what unity is all about. So we're seeking to understand that on a much, much deeper level below the conscious mind. And the unconscious mind, I think what's below that is the soul. Mm-hmm. So we're on a soul level, we're seeking to come together as one.
Mm-hmm.
Because essentially we are one. But that's only a concept until you actually go into your soul or you open up the spirit of unity to come between us.
So what happens to a person when they see themselves in other people? And this could be for better or for worse. And this is also sort of the leap point as to wherever it is that you are with yourself in your life currently. Maybe that's not such a great place, and maybe it's an amazing place. But what do you think happens to people when they see themselves in others?
Well, we like what we see or we don't. And the things that we like, again, that's maybe the grounds that pulls us closer. Mm-hmm. And the things that we don't like are maybe the things that we don't like about ourselves, or the very things that we've been able to get over in our life. So if I've had a problem with anger in the past, I may have no tolerance or willingness to be around angry people. But it's when something that we don't like in another person causes us to react, I think it's grounds to investigate the topic of healing a little deeper on that subject. Mm-hmm. Because the things in me that I've truly gotten over no longer bother me when it arises in somebody else, because it's not my issue. We only get angry over our own issues, or we only like what is our like the things that we like. We tend to like that in others, and the things that anger us, we tend to get angry in others.
Right, because if two people, like, okay, say for an example, you are an angry person and you have some traumas and things like that, and you happen to come across somebody that after enough conversation, you discover that they too have had similar traumas, but they're still stuck in this angry thing. And let's say that you and this other person connect and you become friends. I wonder, because this is a matter of responsibility now, is how are you going to use this friendship? Or is it going to be a thing where you dwell on the things that frustrate you, and now that's like your bond, and you just stay rooted in that thing that probably should be dealt with, or do you move together to help one another out? I have a curiosity about how people handle that responsibility when they find another person is broken like yourself, and whether you just stay there or not.
I think whether you stay or go depends on your willingness to move forward in your healing, in your growth, and whether you know consciously or unconsciously whether you're willing to move forward. There, if you're kind of stuck in, or you don't want to have any forward movement. And I've met people that they're just happy to be where they're at. They're not happy. Like, they're not happy at all. But they've kind of locked it down in their mind that they're going to stay in the realm of what they feel is comfortable for them. And they may just laugh off the notion of healing. They may laugh off a lot of things that I hold dear, and that's okay. I'm fine with that. What tends to happen is that when somebody comes into your life and they're in your field of consciousness, in your range or your aura, that if you've actually been able to successfully get over certain situations in your life, there's an energetic fix that happens. There's a consciousness that is exuded in your aura that helps them heal. Mm-hmm. And that's the importance of really getting over your stuff, and that's sort of there's a grace in becoming, living your purpose and becoming the person that you truly are on a soul level, because you help and heal people just by being you, and not through our efforts or what we say or don't say. It's just directly by our energy field. That's the basis of transmission. Transmission is something that happens when you're with a teacher. You're with somebody who is a little further along the path in level of consciousness. And it's not, nobody's higher or lower than you. It's not a higher or lesser or more. It's just different states. Some people are in different states of consciousness.
Right.
So you had said earlier that unity is something that you need to experience, and it's hard to describe. It's actually just a concept until it's experienced. So can you break down a little bit how we can begin experiencing unity? Like, how do we start moving in that direction?
How we begin to experience unity again is you know, by learning to drop the commentary in your mind that creates difference. You know, like I've spent time with people that are very different than me, and been able to see myself in them on a deep, much deeper level. And so the objections that your mind will start to throw up when you meet somebody, like, I don't know how many times I meet people and my mind will throw up things like odd duck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you meet somebody in a bookstore and you'll think, God, that guy's an odd duck.
Yeah.
And, at the depth of what's between you and that person that you feel is odd, is there's a unity. And if we can drop our positions and search for that common ground that ties, then we start to eradicate the things that create distance between us and other people.
So it's better to focus on the similarities rather than the immediate differences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it is easy to make judgments on people.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of people I know that on the surface level, it may even be someone that my mind's saying, well, you know, he or she doesn't seem like the most trustworthy person. I don't know how we come up with these things. It might be maybe you met someone in your past that wasn't trustworthy and kind of had a similar look or a similar vibe to them. And it turns out that they're really great people.
And I think this is where we can grow as people greatly, is in our ability to become more tolerant and resilient with people's differences. And that's something we were talking about I think it was the last chapter about tolerance. You know, there was a little piece that I read about tolerance is the right button to push when you're finding that you've had enough and you just can't take anymore. And that's something that if we bring into our relationships with people, and there, when we insert tolerance and look for understanding and compassion and all those things,
mm-hmm.
you know, or if we go back to love, what are the qualities of love? Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not boastful. You know, when we look at all those qualities, then that there's a real formula to getting to the unity between you and another. So how do we create unity? Through tolerance, patience, keeping a loving air in your mind with people. And it's okay not to like everyone. I don't think we're supposed to like everybody. And I don't think we're supposed to hang out with people that, you know, are just going in a different direction. I guess the difference is, and this is something I've said many times, I don't have to like everyone, and I don't like everyone. But it is my job to love them,
mm-hmm.
regardless of their differences or how much I don't like somebody. I still feel there's a sense of duty to try to maintain a loving air.
Well, in regards to not liking everyone, like when we're talking about our group of friends, I can only maintain so many friends,
mm-hmm.
like where I actually feel like I'm a quality friend. But I think it's important to focus on a handful of friendships in real life, maintain them, and anything else is nothing more than an affiliated network, which is helpful too. But I find personally I unify more with people the more I spend time with them. And you got to get to know them. Mm-hmm. And I think that understanding ourselves can help us understand others too, which really make for better friendships and relationships. What do you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, the more I've gone into the depths of my heart, the more I find myself in yours.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something to really think about. that it's an experience that I've had, that I've found myself in the heart of many people.
Yeah, I understand that. I've felt that as well. But that takes time to get to. Like, that's not something that, at least for me, I think we all maybe understand that at different rates of speed, where we come to realize how much of someone is in you and where you see these similarities. Mm-hmm. And then you start to really cultivate those things because you see that as being the value in the friendship. I really like people who aspire to things. That's mm-hmm. my big thing. I like people who really push for things if they really, really want something. And I've noticed with getting myself involved in different communities of people, especially through this podcast, for an example, you find people who have a great amount of drive for things. And those are people that inspire me. Mm-hmm. And then I end up becoming more inspired, and then I'm more likely to do more with myself. If I spent my time with people who had no aspirations, it would lessen my own, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Here's something that you said to me one day. You talked about always moving the needle, you know, and that, you know, when we meet, you know, that I move the needle for you. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think that's important to seek out in your life, people that move the needle for you, people that inspire you, motivate you to maybe dig in a little deeper, discover who you are on a deeper level. And by doing so, by the further you dig in yourself, the more you find understanding of others and their situations, mm-hmm. because it puts you out in the world. It puts you in front of people. It puts you in the real situations through many thousands. I've done well over 10,000 tattoos. So I've had at least 10,000 interactions with people. Mm-hmm. And in the thousands of interactions that I've had, and through my tattooing, through my charitable work, through creating projects such as this that you and I are doing, I've been able to get in front of people and really get deep into the depths of what somebody's really about.
The very nature of the spark we carry in our soul seeks to be in unity with others. When we experience solidarity with one another, it evokes memories of our origin. It causes us to remember that we all come from the flame of God.
And so we talked about this in the relationships chapter with the sacred relationship, and that was something that we touched on at the very tail end of that part of our interview series. What I'd like to know is how is unity the premise of creating a sacred relationship?
Unity happens naturally in a more sacred relationship. Unity arises in the act of surrendering to love, you know, and when you surrender yourself in love with another person, there's an automatic unity that sort of comes between you. But there's in a sacred relationship, it's one that's also built on your personal growth and supporting each other in your personal growth and your relationship with God. So unity happens more deeply because you're all kind of pointed in the same direction, mm-hmm. toward the same thing. So in a sacred relationship, it's a relationship that's much different in the dynamic, because it really has a focus and a direction versus just random experiences and going from one day to the next. No, there's really a single pointedness to a sacred relationship, because the dynamic, like, is what I just said. We're pointed to God. We're pointed at our growth for ourselves and for each other. And that's a pretty definite idea on where we're going and what we're doing. So that, mm-hmm. that kind of focus opens up the unity to come and gift us with its presence.
Now, if we go back to just about the very beginning of this series, we talked a lot about the checkbox, like checking off these big things that we need. You had discussed it as your vacation property, your home, getting a Harley and a vehicle, et cetera, et cetera. And money, of course, to fund all of that. But what's really interesting is how you talk about in the chapters how unity helps decrease the need for temporary external experiences. I'd like for you to educate us on that.
Okay, for a temporary external experience is just what life tends to be on a daily basis. They're temporary. There's just so many temporary things in life. So all things in form are temporary, you know, and all of our thoughts and feelings are temporary. You know, everything is in motion and it's passing through. It's not the only thing that's solid and stable about it is that the energy that holds it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be created nor destroyed. So the experience of unity takes away the focus and the importance of stuff and things. And the experience of unity, it fills you up sort of with the presence of God, which is eternal and it's all encompassing. And I have this saying that comes to mind a lot. Only a fool would ask for more when he has everything. And and with the presence of God in my heart and wrapping itself around me, only a fool would ask for more when he has everything. You know, I feel a sense of completeness that washes over me. So temporary external things, a new car, it's a gadget. It's no longer an extension of my manhood.
Right.
You know, it's a gadget. My house, it's a sleeping device. You know, my phone is a communication device. It's not my life. If you took it away for a week, I'm going to get by. I'm going to be just fine.
Yeah.
So, you know, it removes the desire from your mind. And that was the biggest thing that I've experienced in my states of consciousness where I felt a union with God and with people is that I'm left wanting for nothing.
I would think that there may be people where they are, where they're sitting today and what they're experiencing and how they feel about certain things. When you list off those certain things like vehicle, house, phone, these sorts of luxuries. I mean, a house is necessary, of course, but what kind of house? You know, do we need a $500,000 mansion where we live, by the way? That's quite a lot of house. You might live in Vancouver or something and that's still a shack, but in any case, people might still think, yeah, but man, like, how is it that what you're talking about, having God within you and feeling the presence of unity, how is that better than a sweet new vehicle or like an amazing house or a massive TV? And it's like, there might be people that might be totally blocked off to realizing, because I think, like we said earlier, best experience not described.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I guess what I'm trying to say is that people need to move in the direction to just experience it a little bit and then make up your own mind, because it's easy to get caught up in the idea that what we're talking about could not possibly be better than all of these luxuries.
Mm-hmm. I'm not promoting a future reward that's inaccessible until later. I'm presenting a solid and stable reality that's here right now. And it's not a faraway place or a difficult space. It's here right now. And it's not something that we have to strive to become or to be. Mm-hmm. It's something that we surrender to. So surrendering deeply into the source of who we are, into the silence, it instantly grounds and stabilizes us into a different reality. And when we just keep falling back into that more and more, unity comes in visits. It's an experience that, you know, can be had, you know, by the serious seeker. But if you can't compare it to to other things because there is no comparison in my experience. But until I experience a place of unity with God, then I couldn't relate. So it's like if you've never eaten a apple pie, how would you know how good it tastes?
Mm-hmm.
Or how good it doesn't taste, you know, for that matter.
Yeah, right. So the way that you explain unity with God in the book, it makes it seem like an unattainable experience. So how does one experience unity that way?
I present it in such a way that it's the enlightened masters that experience unity. But the thing is that our consciousness is in flux all the time. And we will, it's not that enlightenment is the end of our experience. It rather, enlightenment touches down in our experience many times. You could have a great deal of enlightening moments. Mm-hmm. Moments when there's that total surrender and peace that washes over you. Well, therein lies the experience of enlightenment and a unity with what it is that's coming to you. So it sounds far away, but that's only your mind tracking progress. So how far is far? This lifetime, the planet's billions of years old. How far away are you from enlightenment to experiencing unity in respects to the world, to time, to all of time? You know, and how long is your life? Are you measuring it with a ruler? Are you measuring it as this one thing? And so unity is closer than you think, and so is our enlightenment. There's a lot of people that talk about, you know, the think that they put masters on pedestals, but the master lives inside of you. And the idea is that you return to the master in you. And then you let go of what's impossible, what seems impossible, and what lives in the realm of not your experience will slowly become more and more possible and eventually becomes your experience.
So if you could explain the different layers of unity.
Okay, so there's at different times, in different experiences, we experience unity in different ways. So there's the one layer of unity is when the spirit of unity joins when two or more gather. So we've all been to a game, a sporting event of some sort, or played a sport with a group of people. Well, in that moment, when two or more people are gathered, there's a unity that opens up. The Christians reference that to in the Bible when it says when two or more gather in thy name, I am there also. That's a verse from the Bible. So that's one sense of unity. And I think it's the most relatable one because we've all gathered together for one singular cause and felt this nice experience from being unified together. So we can do that at any time. And so if you want to experience unity, get a friend and do something together. Mm-hmm. There's a unity that automatically opens up. Now, when you get involved in something where you're gathering two or more people together and it's in the purpose of love, the purpose of the event is for love, there's a greater amplification of the power to co-create. And the power of unity sort of gets increasingly stronger. Now, I've experienced this through charity events. When I've put on charity events, such as the one I did last year in 2017, it was an event called A Pause for Love. And we did Be Love Tattoos for the day and semicolons. The event was sort of framed around love and supporting people who are struggling with mental illness or people that are just struggling in life. So we did that event in the support of that. So love was the premise of that event. And We created tattoos that said "Be Love," just a letter B and a heart. And the unity that was in that arena, you know, it was just incredible. I've put on many charity events, but that one was very special. And I think because love was part of the reason, it amplified it greatly. And that level of unity can be experienced by anyone. No matter where your consciousness lies, where you are on the path, anyone can experience that. And then, so the there's another layer of unity that comes to us, and it comes, so that first layer of unity is more about the external, you gathering with others, and then something internal happens and through that external experience. The next layer going deeper into unity is because what happened on the first layer, even though it was an external thing, it caused something internally. Now, if you take your attention and you turn it inward to, there's an internal aspect in us, it's called the silence. So we go deeper into that, and that brings up a deeper sense of unity. It brings up the singularity of our soul and the understanding the depth of what that is. Mm-hmm. And that can be, that layer of, or type of unity is experienced by devoted spiritual seekers. You know, if you kind of just, and you don't have to be like have any religious background or even call yourself spiritual. Someone who's devoted to going into the presence of love inside themselves can experience unity. So a person who's devoted to the unfoldment of their awakening can deeply experience that layer of unity. And the last step of unity is when you dissolve what you think is you, the sense of you into God, into your soul. Mm-hmm. And that's something where we just keep surrendering. And that's kind of where I'm at in my life. I keep surrendering, and there's so much more to just let go of. There's more to dissolve. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it as a process or as a daunting task or something that, you know, maybe I'll hit next lifetime. I see it as my current reality that's moving rapidly towards me.
Mm-hmm. And so how does unity leave you desireless for anything other than this moment?
It has a way of placing us deeply into the moment. And this moment is a doorway into unity. So when we actually enter this moment where we get out of our mind and we start to rest in the silence. And then the deeper we rest in the silence, the more anchored we get to the moment, which again releases us deeper of the mind. And so the mind could be like this little chattering way off in the distance. Mm-hmm. It's almost like when in our everyday life that there's like a little pedestal or somebody in there with a megaphone talking to us all the time. And then when we actually surrender ourselves to the moment, or we go into the silence where unity is found or arises in, then that little guy with the megaphone screaming in your head, suddenly it's like he's like standing on a mountain maybe three vistas away. It's just if there's voices, if there's things going on, you're no longer paying attention to it. That's no longer the object of your affection.
Unity is a divine truth. There is a rapid discovery of that truth when we love one another, for love itself lives in the heart of unity.
And so why does unity eradicate the need for change or welcome it if it comes?
It's a mind that wants things to be different than what they are. Your soul can accept no matter what's happening. And even in horrific situations, the soul can just, it's an unbiased witness to life. You know, if I were to catch my leg on fire, my soul's not gonna be an objection to that. It's going to be my mind that's running towards water.
Right.
So when we get into a place where we feel a sense of, we experience unity, it eradicates the need of the mind. It eradicates our need to change and control, to manipulate what's happening, because the mind can't experience the unity between itself and something else, because the mind is separate. It believes it's separate, and it's based on concepts that we are this singular, not unified unit with other people. You know, it believes there's a me and a you, whereas the soul only sees itself.
So the conversation with unity so far seems to be, like, the big question I think would be, okay, well, there might be people that are not good for me. And maybe there's people that I shouldn't be unifying with, and I should be cautious and use common sense to know who to unify with. So that's part of it. We have to introduce that as well, because it's not like we should, you know, embrace every single person on this planet and unify with everyone, and everyone's great. And there needs to be some common sense and some judgment that guides us towards the right people to unify with. Well, what's your opinion on that idea?
Absolutely, 100%. And I think that's where discernment really comes into play in the path. And I think we need to, as we become more and more awake, we need to understand who and what we're unifying with. We need to be conscious of who and what we're giving ourselves over to. You know, I don't want to be involved in anything that supports suffering and greed, or, you know, destruction of our resources, or that's careless and frivolous and cruelty towards animals. Like, I have to live in clear conscience that I'm making positive choices that are in alignment with my purpose. And there's many things out there that seem harmless on the surface, but are very not good for you, you know. And there are groups of people that have limited beliefs and that detract from your growth and your experience of the nature of your soul. There's groups out there that are, you know, their agenda is to live by their rules and their rules alone. And there's different groups out there, there's different people that their agenda is to get you hooked on drugs, and which, you know, eventually can lead to many dysfunctions or losses in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why not look at one of the things that comes to mind, and I don't know how you feel about talking about this, but Walmart and dollar stores. Uh-huh. Like, is there not a dark cloud over those two operations in the world? Like, why is Walmart selling for less and making millions and then not paying their employees very well? And, you know, and how are they obtaining their goods? The dollar stores, how do they get something for a dollar? Is that ethically gained?
Right.
You know,
my big issue with the dollar store, just to chime in on that, is they contribute to so much landfill waste. Because everything is made not to last. Like, I've heard people say, oh, I'm going to get, like, some tools to build things with at the dollar store. And it's like, okay, whatever. And then they bring it back and it lasts for 5 minutes. And it's like, all right, let's go to the hardware store and get, like, some Mastercraft tools or something of good quality that's actually going to last. So, yeah, I have major issues with those kinds of stores. Not to mention that, but, you know, us owning a flower shop, for an example, and lots of small businesses, a lot of people try to promote that you shop local, et cetera, because those types of big box stores take away business from the little guy.
And I have to be honest here. Like, I have not done my homework on the topic, but it's my instincts to say that somebody's not getting paid when I pay a dollar for a product that should be selling for 10. When I pay a dollar for something that I should be paying $5 for, who's not getting paid? You know, and I've had clients that work for some of these big businesses, and the work ethic and what's expected of them is just unhuman. It's disgusting. And yet we have to be the ones that where our moral meter has to be in place. We have to say, okay, if a business is enforcing their employees to work harder than they can, mm-hmm. if you know, I went into a Subway one time and the owner was yelling at his employee in front of the customers, and I asked the owner, I said, do you think that's appropriate? So that it wasn't me challenging him to engage in an argument, but I wanted to know. I wanted to know, is that appropriate? And he really didn't have any response to me. And I said, well, I'm going to have to leave now because I'm not supporting your business today. And so my moral meter said, this is somebody I can't align with. I can't give this, in clear conscience, I could not give that man my business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's 15 other restaurants to eat at, places that I could purchase food, you know, and I'd rather eat something microwavable than mm-hmm. support somebody who's unethically abusing their employees. Right. And I think that's where people have to really maybe start coming together and saying what's right and what can I do? And people, if you throw up your hands and you say, there's nothing I can do. Yeah, there is. You know, stop supporting things that are not ethical.
Right.
You know?
Okay. Well, that's kind of an interesting subject we're getting onto here, because what you're describing is complacency in people in the flesh. You know, like when we're in a store and we have to address somebody with a concern that you might have, like you just explained with the sandwich shop, a lot of people are just going to sit there and be like, yeah, well, I really want a sandwich, though. I don't really want to get involved with that. A lot of people don't get involved, eh? I only find that it's like with social media, people get involved. On social media, everyone has an opinion. And they all want to make change and all of that. But I feel like in person, everyone's sort of silent. It's rare that I ever see a circumstance and then someone actually interjects and says, you know what, I'm going to have to question you on that. I'm not sure that that's really cool what you're doing. And if people become accustomed to that where no one's ever going to say anything, well, now all of a sudden people feel more at liberty to sort of act out their intolerances, perhaps, or like the things that they're criticizing. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, do you think in our heart we know what's right and what's wrong, that like really deep down, like, or do we have to take inventory of what we morally align with and then just kind of go by our little list that we make for ourselves?
Our soul knows exactly what's right and wrong, 100%. And I don't care if you're a sociopath. The soul of a sociopath knows what's right and wrong. But when the mind goes too far in one direction, we lose touch of reality. And an interesting study is that when somebody lies for the first time, it creates, they've put people on I'm not sure if it's an MRI or what device they use to measure, but they look at brain activity when somebody lies. And the first time they lie, it lights up considerably. The brain lights up and it creates a fair amount of stress. Now, the second time somebody lies, there's not nearly the response. And then what tends to happen is the more you turn a blind eye, the more you lie, you don't go into a deeper, you don't allow what you know to be true and right to prevail, that you sort of start to become numb to it. And you start to change the landscape of your mind. Your mind actually will rewire and accept things that you know are wrong. And it'll start to wire itself so that you can justify the wrongs. And so what I'm asking people is in the pursuit of unity that we look at some things that don't seem right. Why can I pay a dollar for something that's worth $10? Is that right to you? I don't want to attack the dollar stores, but I want to just bring some awareness. Like, what is wrong here? Like, and ask yourself, if I'm sitting in a house that's worth $200,000, I can afford a $3 or $5 wrench. Let's get some perspective on this. And if I can't afford it, then maybe I should save up for it. You know?
Yeah.
But again, like I don't mean to present an argument that, you know, makes anyone feel bad or makes me come across as I don't know, frustrated, or I just think it's so important to really look at, you know, what it is that we're aligning with, and that could be simply walking into a variety store and seeing something and then deciding not to support that, or to maybe pull the owner aside and say, look, I didn't appreciate your behavior, and making people accountable. And maybe that would be a situation that would create a deeper respect between you and the owner of a business. Or
just imagine this for a moment. Like, if you are, well, we'll use the sandwich shop guy for a minute, just as an example. So if you're the owner of the sandwich shop and you're the one that's beaking off to your employee, and you in your mind, because of so many times that you may have done this before and no one's ever said a word, it might get slightly uncomfortable. Like, maybe you can feel the discomfort in other people that it's like, ooh, I don't really like being around that. But you do know that no one is going to challenge you, confront you about your actions and the way you're behaving. If there's no fear or expectation that someone's actually going to call you out on it, you're more likely to do it. You're more likely to freely act like that. So now, if it was flipped around and every time that you were about to do something like that, you're like, oh, is that Ned guy going to like pop out of the corner and say, hey, that's not right. I mean, if people were thinking that to themselves, that there's a chance that someone's actually going to call them out, like the social justice, right? Mm-hmm. Just people actually taking some action.
Yeah.
This is something that really annoys me is how people don't speak up. People just, I don't know what it is. I'm not sure if maybe it's uncomfortable, I suppose, or where am I going to go with this? Like, how am I going to diffuse this? Or maybe they just don't care. Maybe they're totally numbed out and they're not affected. It's like, well, it's not my problem.
And I think a different way to spin this too, and not to be to ring it out too much, but to flip it in a different direction where you say, if say you're that person that is mistreating somebody, or say you're the person that is supporting something you know is not positive or loving, ask yourself, you know, if that was my daughter, how would I speak to this person? If I knew this business employed my daughter, would I still give it business? Mm-hmm. You know, would I want my family working there? Would I want, you know, my family working in a place in China where there's no rules or regulations around children working or people breathing in toxic fumes all day, making plastic goods to sell in Canada? Would you send your child over there to work? Then why would you send your child in to let it buy something in the store? Or why would you walk in that store and buy something? Mm. So let your actions be out of love. And, you know, is it loving to do or purchase or involve yourself with this arena of things? Mm-hmm. You know, whether it be people or goods or, you know.
The heart of unity houses many guests. Contentment is one of them.
Now, the other thing I was touching on a little bit about social media and how it has its pros and cons. When we're talking about connecting with people, it has its pros and cons. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What are they, in your opinion?
I love the social reach, the reach of social media, rather. I absolutely think that's amazing. I get up every day and I put a post on social media, and I love how it's affecting people. And I've been doing this now for a couple of years, and there's some momentum now to all the posts that I've been making. And like I had a young person contact me yesterday, and she said that how she believes in love, and there's many times where she gets disenchanted with people, and then she comes to my page to get a reset. She says, I just need to come to your page and look at and read some of your quotes, and I believe in love again, because I believe in love, and that's what she was telling me. And the amount of messages that pour in, and comments, and the likes and the shares on the post, where it's spreading something positive, for a 3-second interaction, like I may spend 20 minutes making a picture to post, and then I spend 3 seconds posting it. So a 21 minute interaction has created thousands of moments out in social media. Mm-hmm. What a wonderful payback, you know? And so it's a great tool to communicate with, and for quick communication. It's a great way to communicate effortlessly with people around the world. Mm-hmm. You can spread love, but on the other side of it, it can perpetuate things that are not true. You know, I can make a post up, and my ideas may be askew, and then I can perpetuate something that's not true, or I can perpetuate. There's people out there that perpetuate darkness. Like I've come across several memes on Facebook that is using derogatory words towards women, and saying that I'm just a stupid girl, and I'm eventually one day maybe I'll get smart enough to leave his ass, or just stupid stuff like that, or things that put people down, and they're in a funny meme, but it's not funny to me. And I, every time I see one of those memes that are very dark and in nature, I'll say, I think you're better than this. I think you as a person are much better than this post. And then I'll go on to say, you know, 5 or 10 things I love about that person. And it's amazing the effect that has on some of these things. But so social media can become, it can have a dark side to it too. And then it can become an addiction, where you're needing likes and shares and comments to derive your self-worth. And that's something we talked about in the last post, is that your self-worth isn't the whole topic of self-worth is based on the need of your ego. So, you know, so the social media can perpetuate your ego in a sense, where mm-hmm. it becomes an extension of your ego. How cool are you? And you're gauging it on how many likes, shares, and comments you get.
Mm-hmm. And the other side of that equation too is virtual interaction versus real life interaction. And just to quickly sidestep for a moment, I've noticed this, not just myself saying it, but almost everybody who makes a comparison between their waking life and their social media life, they always refer to their waking life as real life, which would then, that's in a way that's saying that social media is not real life. It's not real at all. Maybe it's not real or life. It's neither one. But in any case, I'd like to talk a little bit about how virtual interactions act as a detriment to human connectivity.
Well, I think we both could answer this question. How do you think that virtual interactions become a detriment? You know, what are your thoughts? I'd love to hear your ideas on this first.
Yeah, okay. Virtual interactions are easier to say what's maybe the thing that's boiling underneath. sometimes because there's this filter, it's a lot harder to approach a person face to face. And especially if you make eye contact and you say the same thing, that poses a level of discomfort onto people. And so people, especially nowadays, I'm finding when we talk about the sandwich shop guy, you know, people are less likely to be objectional, to say what's really on their mind, to be honest and truthful with other people, even talk about meaningful subjects. People are losing the ability to communicate. That's my thoughts. I feel like because of texting and social media posts and comments, YouTube comments, where all of a sudden everyone's a troll and a total asshole. It's like, where does that come from? Like, how is it that social media gives people the liberty to be rude or to have no filter, quote unquote? You got to wonder if they're just acting out, like misbehaving like a small child, you know, like you get them in the room face to face. Now, how are they going to behave? I see a lot more polarizing attributes in people from what they're like in real life to what they're like in social media land. And here's the other thing too. Say you and I connected on social media and we never saw each other once before in real life, but through some kind of grapevine, a mutual friend of yours, I posted something. Oh, cool. Let's be friends. So now you and I are friends on Facebook and we start communicating through Messenger, through texting, not even like through voice, which I'm a huge advocate for that. I like to practice speaking a lot, so I don't text very much. But in any case, you and I are talking lots. And then there comes a point where you and I actually get to meet. Now, because of the way that we alter our speech and our mannerisms and the things that we're more likely to say through social media and texting because of, again, that filter, now there's sort of this weird, uncomfortable thing that happens because you and I now have some history. We have some knowledge of one another, but we've never shared it face to face. And there becomes this anticipation and expectation when you actually finally get to meet someone. And I see this happening too, like in my community, for an example, with NAM. This is a good example. A lot of people who listen to this who know what NAM is, it's a really big music convention, and it's for all different musical instruments, recording equipment, etc. So what happens is these people are connecting over their posts on Instagram and Facebook and YouTube. They're making comments, they're getting connected, and now they're like, they're aware of each other and they're associated, they're affiliated with one another. The way that you portray yourself on social media might not be anything like what you are in real life. And I've met people who are super bubbly, like over the top generous. Like, it seems like they can't stop talking, and like they would just be this glowing presence. And then you meet them in real life and it's like dead as a doornail. And it's like, okay, so that's what you're really like. So people are creating personas of themselves on social media. I feel like that's a really big thing. They're creating an image of themselves in perfection on social media that's without flaws.
So all of this topic came up in the chapter of unity, and how unity comes back into play is that there's ways that we're connecting, and there's things that we're plugging into that build unity, and there's things that take away from our unity. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for us to take a look at and bring balance into the different areas of our lives. And because unity is such an abstract concept, you know, there's things that definitely detract from our unity. And creating a good balance with the topic of social media and where you're plugging in is really helps us to gain that experience of unity itself.
Well, yeah, again, with social media, like you had described, there's an efficiency to our message. There's a way to touch a lot of people with very little input.
That's right.
Right? So it's really efficient. But my plea to everybody, get in front of people. Get in front of people. Have conversations with people. Share your opinions with people. Have debates. This is all really healthy for people. Don't just leave all of the challenging interactions for online where it's easier. Put yourself in difficult situations. You'll grow as a person.
Mm-hmm. Unifying with our soul calls us to set ourselves down. When you do this, you give your soul the opportunity to rise within you with all its glory. Be alone with your soul. Come to your soul empty of yourself. In your aloneness with your soul, there's a great comfort and unity within you. There are many guests in your mind that can be very distracting. When you give yourself over to your soul without distraction, your soul reveals itself to you. The depths to which you will discover your aliveness in your soul is endless. Dissolve any sense of you in the presence of your soul. You do this with practice. The idea is to keep practicing until there's no longer a you that is trying. The barrier to unifying with your soul is your mind. When your attention is placed on thinking and thoughts or anything outside of you, you give yourself to whatever has your attention. By making your soul your only focus, you amplify the soul's presence in you.
When the consciousness of unity permeates you, a deep sense of completeness washes over you. It leaves you desireless for anything other than this moment.
So what we're just discussing before had a lot to do with unity within ourselves and creating unity within ourselves. This is much like the relationships chapter where we discuss how to have a better relationship with yourself and how that's important before you then graduate into fostering better relationships with other people. The same applies for the unity chapter. And now we are going to talk about how to create unity within your community. So to start things off, Ned, I'd like to ask just to illustrate the importance of creating unity in the community.
This is a topic that has been coming to mind for a while for me. And I think it's a direct result of the charitable work that I've done. Mm-hmm. And because my charity events have created this wave of unity and the effects of that, I could see how positive it was in the community. I think that when the community comes together on something, it brings out the goodness in each other, and it brings out a spirit that enlivens our soul. There's something about getting together as a community that, you know, is soulful. It mm-hmm. It enlivens your spark. It makes you feel grateful to be born. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what I noticed after my last charity event, where people out in the community now are connecting when they see a little semicolon tattooed on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
There's that connection, a sense of I was part of something that you were part of. Or when someone sees a Be Love tattoo, you know, there's that connection that, again, I was part of something that you were part of. We're somehow connected because we were there in that place.
Mm-hmm.
We were all there experiencing love that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stories that have kind of funneled their way back to me have really, really touched me in such a deep place. People telling me how they've made new friends, how they've felt more accepted and loved by complete strangers because we had a charity event. So there's the importance of it right there. It's bringing people together in the spirit of love, like the event that I did anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is something that we need to really think about, is how can we create a greater sense of unity in our community?
Yeah. And we wanted to talk about some examples and how to create unity in the community. And I'd like to start that by actually telling a little story of my own in how this works. And you actually are the reason why this started. And you're just talking about your charities. This is actually what spawned something within both my wife and I and our flower shop. And it was a couple of years ago, and you were doing, that was the semicolon year, and you were doing the semicolon tattoos. And you had asked me if I'd like to participate in that and putting some bands together and some, have some musical entertainment, because the lineups were long. Like, you had done this in your backyard, and then just up the street, there's a rec center. And you had people around the block waiting in line and so on and so forth to get their semicolon tattoo. But then it's not just about, okay, wait in line, get your tattoo, now go home. You had barbecue, you had what was going on at the rec center, and people could go there and hang out and communicate with one another. And it was Viking and I that sort of put that together, and Aaron Allen. Us three were responsible for getting the bands and the entertainment, the musical entertainment together. So long story short, we did the event. It was very successful. Then Amanda and I had our own idea that we would get carnations. And this was all in light, I should say, this is all in light of teen suicide and mental health concern, right? So we wanted to do our own charity through our flower shop. And this was a direct inspiration from being involved in a community event that you had hosted, right? So what we had done is we had got carnations, and to explain why we use carnations, there was a couple of reasons. One is logistical. They last a very long time. So our idea was to put these carnations into pails and then put them into different stores here in Ingersoll, and people could donate whatever they want, and then they take a carnation. But the idea as well, because, you know, the carnations are very long-lasting flowers, and they're actually quite inexpensive as well to buy. On a symbolic level, carnations are called the mother flower, and they don't shed any of their petals. They're, in fact, the only flower that don't shed their petals. And we saw a symbolism in that with our community, that we should all stick together and that petals shouldn't fall. That represents people, et cetera, et cetera. You can paint the picture there with the symbolism. But in any case, what was interesting about that is how everyone was so on board with it. I think a couple of people said, no, thank you. But an overwhelming amount of people that we asked got on board, including McDonald's, Tim Hortons, these bigger stores that actually provided quite a, like they yielded quite a lot of donations. And in the end result, which what we donated to CMHA, which is the Canadian Mental Health Association, was to the tune of $1,800. And that was really cool. It took a couple of weeks to get it all done. It was a lot of work trekking back and forth to different stores and collecting money, replenishing the flowers, etc. But the thing is once you pick up the ball and you start walking with it and you start making decisions and you're now taking action, it becomes so motivating. And some people might be wondering to themselves, well, how can I gain a greater sense of purpose? So this is a really good step in that direction. You can start doing things in your community to make it a better place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's incredible. Are there other examples, Ned, that come to mind where people can start getting involved in their community and creating a sense of unity?
Yeah, and that's a great example, Seamus. You gave what you could in accordance to your circumstance. And no matter what your circumstances is in your life, you are in a position to still to give. Whether it's something as small as a smile or a handshake or a hug, that if that's all that you have to give, that's probably more than you realize. Because mm-hmm. sometimes these small gestures actually create more sense of community than the bigger ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we connect with others, it helps build community. And so find ways to connect with people. Like if you are on social media, we just went through a big long discussion about social media here, but use it as a positive platform. If somebody pops in your mind, I make it a habit of sending them a message and saying, you crossed my mind. I never message someone and say that to them if they haven't crossed my mind. But if somebody crosses my mind, I send them a message. I mean, I don't know why they came to my mind. So now my job is to just let them know that they were in my heart today.
Mm-hmm.
And so that Now, just something as a whim that passed through me, I've made a connection with somebody else. Look strangers in the eyes. Make it a practice to look at people and engage the world. Look for ways that you can give yourself over to surrendering yourself to another. Like if somebody drops something, pick it up. Find a way to praise people. Praise opens up a dialogue that like no other. You know, praise. When I was with the Ashayas, their meditation techniques were based on praise, gratitude, and love. And then there was a cognition technique that helped ground you into the moment. So, but when you look at praise, it's a doorway into gratitude. If I say, Seamus, that's a very nice wolf shirt you're wearing today.
This shirt, shout out to my dude, Ryan Claxton. I know he loves my wolf shirts, but this shirt, I have two of them. But this shirt gets a lot of praise.
Yeah. So if I say, Seamus, I like your wolf shirt today, what comes next?
Well, I really like your laid-back t-shirt, and thank you so much for complimenting my wolf shirt.
Yeah, see, there's praise, gratitude, and what's between us? There's a sense of love, because I love your shirt, and I love you in it.
That's awesome.
But all jokes aside, you know, greet the world with your heart, you know, engaged. Greet the world with a smile. You know, be friendly to your family and fellows. Bring up kindness. Bring up your ability to love. And in your ability to love, your sense of community will get bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. The other thing too, like just to add real quick to the charity story with the flowers. So when it came to, and this is an interesting thing. I feel like when you're doing something purposeful, others sense it and want to help you succeed. It's not like a necessarily like maybe a mystifying sort of thing where circumstances come up that are difficult to figure out why they turned out so well. Sometimes it's just people recognizing your civic duty and what you're trying to do for your community, and they see value in it and they want to add to it because they want to be involved in something that's good. And so when it came to get the flowers, it was remarkable because I called a few distributors of ours, people that we work with, and it was actually Hoffland who I called, and I told them about this project. And what they said to me is, well, actually, we have these carnations that are, you know, they're too old to sell, but they're still good, but their quality and their standards are very high if they're going to sell any kind of product. So they gave me $2,000 in carnations. I didn't have to pay a cent for any of them. So they were the product in order to get this thing rolling was given to us. We never had to pay anything because they understood that we weren't making any money. Like everything that came through as a donation went directly to the foundation. And so I think with them knowing that, they really wanted to help us succeed in our mission and what we wanted to do. So I just wanted to say to everybody that when you start doing something like this, people tend to see the value in it and want to help you succeed. But it's sometimes you got to pick up the ball and you got to go with it and you got to start making those moves. And you can start inspiring all kinds of people and they'll start achieving as a community that it's going to be successful.
Mm-hmm. And I think the real secret to charity events is to, you know, involve your community as much as you can and not to have expectations on your volunteers, mm-hmm. to just allow them to give the any way they can. And then one of the last lessons I've learned is not to expect how people will receive your charity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to be able to give without expectation.
Mm-hmm. Now, with all of that being said, you do suggest in the book rather quickly that you feel that we as a society are losing our sense of community. And so I'd like to know what evidence points you to that conclusion.
I find that people don't really engage with people. They tend to stay on the surface And sometimes I've noticed that people, if you engage with a stranger, they're suspicious of your intentions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we become very busy as a society, and we sort of brush things off as, I'm busy, I don't have time for that. And we're so engaged in our own stuff that we don't make time to connect. And in the fact of the state of affairs of some of the social abilities in our youth, their ability to converse face to face is somewhat alarming at times. And not just in our youth, but in all ages, sometimes the ability to converse socially is greatly retarded in some people, and they're not able to make that face to face communications, mm-hmm. which in turn tells me that they're not connecting to other people either,
mm-hmm.
or if they are, it's very poor interactions.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think there's a general responsibility deference at times, and it's evidence when you go into a business like we were talking earlier, something unethical is happening, but the restaurant's full of patrons and nobody's noticing.
Mm-hmm. You know,
would that happen 20 years ago? Because maybe the shop owner would say, hey, that's Ernie's daughter, you know. You don't be talking to her like that, or you would know the family. And I see a lot of earphones in and heads down.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not, and I'm not one to paint the world as going to hell in a handbasket. That's not my trip, because I think it's so easy for the mind to just calculate the bads and the losses, and then forget about the wins and all the goodness that's happening around us.
Mm-hmm.
All I'm suggesting is that, you know, we are losing a bit of sense of community. And the bigger message here is, I would like to encourage people to engage a little bit more. Try to put the idea or the concept of community in your mind, and figure out ways that you can help build a stronger sense of that in your community.
The greatness in me is needed by others. When I share myself, the world becomes a better place.
Mm-hmm. And I want to just reflect on Panic in the Park for a moment. Because what was the term again? Social deference?
Yeah.
Okay.
Responsibility deference.
Yeah, responsibility deference. So my thought with this is that people are waiting for other people to do the thing. You know, so in that situation, the park is full of lots of people, so no one's really doing anything because everyone's assuming someone else will do it. And as you said specifically, if there had been only one person in the park, well, they're going to act. But because there's a space filled with people, no one's doing anything. And so when we talk about our community and perhaps a lack of community, it might be because a community consists of many people and we're just all just waiting for someone else to initiate something, or a movement, or a charity, or even just talking to one another.
And the thing too is that if we can engage heart-centered interactions, that's how we purposefully build community. And this is something that's been a very big topic for me lately, is my involvement with heart-centered interactions. Mm-hmm. I feel like if I'm actually going to amp up my path and my devotion to bringing myself into communion with God, then I have to amp up my heart-centered interactions. And by doing so, I'm connecting with other people more. And then I'm connecting on a deeper level. The quality of interaction that happens when you're engaged in your mind is somewhat of a shallower, maybe a negative or a fearful interaction. And that's sort of what I was prefacing in my answer to why I think communities were slipping in that department, because I think a lot of us are trapped in our minds, and myself included too. I'm not always resting in my heart and exuding love, and butterflies don't fly out of my ears. But the sense I have is that when I'm in my mind, I can sometimes get fearful or negative, and whereas when I'm in my heart, I know how to be loving and thoughtful and caring. Mm-hmm. And my heart is community. Mm-hmm. Whereas my mind is just my ego.
I think this is a good time now to paint a picture. Tell us a story about the trip that you went up north with your little brother and the takeaways from that experience.
Yeah, that was a story I shared in the book. My little brother and I were invited to come up to a powwow up north, up by Wyerton. And so we were leaving the powwow, and we had a great day. It was so much fun. We took a road trip, which is always fun. And then we went and experienced the powwow. We ate some Indian food, and we just had a really great time. And I saw some friends that I knew up there. So it was interesting to see the different Indians from different cultures. There was Incans and just different tribes of Indians and bands. Mm-hmm. So we were leaving the show, the powwow, and we're thinking, you know, that was the main event, the powwow. This is what a great day. We had so much fun. Now we get to drive all the way home, you know. But as I was driving out to the main road, I had an intuition, and my intuition didn't make any sense at all. My intuition was telling me that when I got to the corner, that I had to go right. But right would take me up the Tobermory and to nowhere else. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, well, this makes no sense at all. So I look over at my little brother, and I pull the car over, and I says, okay, we got a situation here. And my little brother's looking at me like, you know, what's going on? And I said, well, okay, I got this intuition that I should go right, but that's going to present a real problem, because we can't get home if we go right. Mm-hmm. We have to go left to go home. And I said, what I think what's happening here is we're being presented an adventure. And I said, I don't know about you, but I'm not sure whether we should do this or not. I said, I think I should leave this up to you. Do you think that you and I have had enough of an adventure today and it's time to go home? Or do you think that the adventure's still in front of us? What do you want to do? What should we do? I don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, let's go on the adventure. And I was hoping he'd say that.
Yeah.
So we did. We get to the corner. I turned right, and I said, okay, now we have to really pay attention. Because it was intuition that told me that I was supposed to go right, and I don't know what's going to come next, but I know that if we pay attention to our surroundings and we just watch, something's going to happen. So if you see a sign or a somebody's maybe broken down the side of the road, maybe we're supposed to help somebody today. I don't know what's going to happen. So he's like, okay, yeah, this is, and it was fun because we're waiting. So we pull into a variety store. We wander around. I said, okay, when you go in, just look around, talk to the clerk, talk to everyone in the store. You never know who's got this message or why we're coming, going, doing this. Mm-hmm. So we stopped at the store. We stopped at an antique mall, and we're driving and driving, nothing. And then I saw a sign, and it said it was an art gallery. And the owner of the gallery, his name was Paul Duff. So, and it happened to be open. Now, the gallery, it's, for whatever reason, every time I've driven by that gallery, it's always closed. I said, the gallery's open. This is it. It's got to be it.
Yeah, yeah.
So we pull in, and I'm excited. Like, I'm thinking, this has got to be it. This is a thing. This is why I'm supposed to go right today at this time. And I pull in, and the gallery owner, Paul Duff, is locking the door. So I kind of slink in my seat, and I'm like, oh, man. He's closing. So I get out of the car, and I say to him, I said, it looks like you're closing. Maybe we'll come back another day. And he says, hey, why don't you come on in? I have some time. So right away, I was like, okay, come on. And I'm motioning my little brother to come in with me. And so we go into the gallery, and we first walk in, and it's got this kind of musty old smell, and the paintings kind of match the smell. It was old landscape paintings that weren't painted very well. And then we get into another room, and it's got some other paintings, and seeing a little bit more wildlife or nature paintings, and they're getting a little better, and the smell's getting a little better as we go through. But then we make our way to the very back of the store in his gallery. And the paintings now, the theme had changed. A lot of them were landscapes, but there were spiritual themes. There was Jacob's ladder, the burning bush, the Jesus praying in the forest, Mary. He just, all these really spiritually motivated themes. And so the room was lit up with skylights, and it just had such a warm, inviting atmosphere. And so I say to the owner, the words fell out of me. I said, I'm an artist. Any suggestions you'd give me as an artist? Well, after about, maybe it was like 45 minutes, he finally stopped talking. And it was just like the stuff that he had said to me, just my jaw dropped. I hit the floor. He told me about my duty as an artist and what I should and shouldn't be doing. But all the things that he taught me were very, he was very wise. And so after he was done, he says, I should better get moving along now. And we concluded our visit. And my little brother and I got back in the car. And I look at him and I said, is it time to go home? He says, yep. And I'm like, we didn't even say a word. Like, we basically just sat there in awe. And I think I said something to him to the tune of, I think we found what we're looking for. He says, yep. but it was such an enlightening conversation. And that's the thing. Like, we met him. We met this stranger, and the sense of community that was built between him and I, he and I and my little brother, there was like this wonderful connection. And what I learned about that story, what I learned from that experience, I shared in my book, and I'll just kind of briefly say, you know, what I learned from it. Because when I sat down and spent some time thinking about it, I really pulled a lot from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the book, I say, his advice was simple, humble, and direct. He taught me about my duty as an artist and how I was to serve people with the gifts that come through me. His instructions taught me how to respect others and how to build community with my art. Here were his instructions. Give yourself over to your canvas. I was to surrender to the process of allowing my work to use me as a vessel. Always remain humble in your endeavors. Even when a crowd assembles around you to watch you work, don't boast or brag. Always remember that we are just artists and we're not saving the world.
Mm-hmm.
Number 3, treat your customers well and make them feel as if they are the most important people in the interactions. Number 4, love being an artist. Those are the 4 things that I learned from him that day. But his instructions covered more than how to be an artist. They were instructions on how to build community. And those, let me rephrase those 4 things. So the first one was to give and to surrender. Number 2 was to practice humility. Number 3, be kind and caring. And number 4 was love. You know, so hidden in those 4 instructions, he had, that was the message. What a powerful message
mm-hmm.
that he gave me that day.
And that seems to justify what we ought to be doing as creators, as artists. And I think this segues pretty well, because you had said it was an older man, older gentleman. And in part, with being more involved with our community, we should also respect our elders as well. Now, how do you feel like we should be with our older generation?
Our elders in the community should be looked at as precious gems. And all my life, and this is something that it's been, I was taught at a young age to respect my elders. And when I remember as a young boy, if I came to the conclusion that if I should respect them, then there's something I can learn from them. So I've always wanted to draw out the wisdom of elders. So that's something that's been a constant theme in my life. Even as a little boy, I would sit in the kitchen with my parents, and I would just watch and I'd listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted what the older people had, but that was wisdom. I wanted to be wise. I wanted to be an elder. I somehow knew at that point in my life that there was gonna come a day when I needed to be an elder. There's a little glimmer in me that I knew that I was gonna be an elder someday, and it was gonna be my turn to be wise. Mm-hmm. And so our elders hold and they carry forward the wisdom that has been gathered up from their age and era. And we need to capture the wisdom and all the things that they've captured in their lifetime. And without involving the elders in our life, we're very weak. We're weak because we forget what's behind us. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we want to dwell in the past, but rather we want to celebrate the past and learn from the triumphs and learn from all the things that didn't work out so well.
Uh-huh.
And that's part of the sense of building a better community, is being connected to all the levels of community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe the fact that we don't celebrate our elders as much as we probably should is a sign of maybe mistakes they made. You know, there was a paradigm when I was a little boy, you know, kids are to be seen, not heard. And maybe the people when our parents now, maybe they weren't wise enough to know that they should be giving themselves over to us. You know, when I went and took a Native cultural course, it's one of the things that when I went to a sacred fire event, there was a guy by the name of Paul Rayfield, and he came up. He was a peacemaker and a firekeeper, and he came up to Ontario and did a teaching and over at the Stevenson camp just down the street from where I'm at. And he did this teaching where he drew a circle, and the elders were connected to the child, to the teen, to the adult, and everything goes back to the elders. In the Native culture, they believe that the child needs to be connected to the elders, the teen needs to be connected to the elders, the adult does. And that's something that, and then the adults and the teens and the child are all connecting with themselves as well.
Hmm.
So I remember that teaching so clearly. And that's something that we need to embrace. We need to share ourselves with elders, and elders need to share to be willing to engage the youth and not just to look at them as pests or know-it-alls or, you know, we need to come together. And elders, I have met a certain amount of elders that are not sharing their wisdom. And I challenge people who have reached the elder stage in their lives to stand up and have a voice. I know I've met elders that said they don't feel like their voice is meaningful or being heard or recognized. And the only, and my advice back to them was to speak louder and clearer.
Beware of the differences that blind us to the unity that binds us, by Houston Smith.
Now in this chapter, you have a diagram explaining the gravity between making the easy choice or making the hard choice. And I'd love for you to break this down, because this is very eye-opening stuff.
Yeah, in the full version, we'll be sure to add this chart to the download. I was at work one day, and I was struggling with one of my coworkers, and instead of submitting to my anger, I went and gave myself a timeout. And while I was giving myself a time out, I suddenly saw this image in my mind's eye. I saw a circle with a dot in the center. And the dot in the center of the circle represented choice. And I was sitting in the middle of a choice. And then at the top was making a positive choice. Above the circle on top was positive choice. Below the circle on the bottom was negative choice. And if I was the dot in the center of a choice, if I went right, if I made the right choice, it was an uphill climb to get to the positive side. Mm-hmm. So by making a positive choice, which is more right to do, and it was hard work because I had to go uphill. But if I was in the center of that circle and I made a negative choice, which went left, it was a downhill slide to get to the negative side of the circle. So, and that's sort of illustrative in life. If it's easy to make a wrong choice and just to snap out the snap and submit to our anger, but, and it's much harder to make a positive choice, which is an uphill climb. But then on the other side of the positive choice, it was to come back to a neutral space in the center of the circle, you got to come downhill. It was an easy slide and then back to center. Whereas when I made a negative, if I make negative choices, it's easy to do that at first, but then on the other side of that choice, it's an uphill climb.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, so that diagram has come to mind, you know, tons of times throughout my days, or when somebody gets in front of me and I want to kind of lash out at them, or something frustrates me and makes me angry, I know I'm faced with a choice. You know, we can do that. We can make this choice about learning how to love each other and ourselves. You know, it's easy to make the negative choice with other people, but that detracts from the sense of community. Sometimes making a harder choice just to love ourselves and love community may be the harder thing to do at the time, but it's better in the long run.
Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of stories that I'd like for you to share. These are really great stories, but the underlying message to them is, why should we embrace difference in a community?
Yeah, chapter 10 in the book, I loaded it full of personal stories or great stories that I've heard over the years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, another one of the stories that I share in that chapter is from Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, the Laundry. So, and it deals with difference in community. So when Jack went overseas to a monastery in Asia, I think it was Asia, upon arriving, he was told he was to bow to his elders. And so he wanted to get some clarification on that so that he knew who he's supposed to be bowing to every time he sees them. Well, then what he was told was that his elders were anything and anybody that's been there longer than him. Well, that means everything. Every hall that he walked into, every courtyard he went through, there was children in the monastery and there was old farmers in the monastery. He had to bow to everybody. So he went about bowing. And at first it was no problem, but then it started getting harder because he's there on a trek for his spiritual enlightenment, but he's bowing to a child that's like screaming in the halls while he's trying to meditate. And he's bowing to a farmer that's just sitting around eating nuts and getting fat and not really caring about spirituality in the least. And so he started building resentments. He's like, why do they get to just sit around and do nothing? And I'm bowing to these people. And the conclusion he made is that he needed to find something to bow to in people. And so when he saw the child running in the hallway screaming, he bowed to their youthfulness. When he saw the farmer sitting around in the halls, he would bow to the wrinkles in his eyes for all the work and toil that he'd put into the earth, caring and feeding his community. You know, he found something to bow to in everyone. And that in itself is a great way for us to build community, Look for something in others that you can bow to versus where something that pulls you apart from them or makes you feel separate. Find something that you can embrace and praise in another.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the last thing I could follow that up with is that I feel like we need to give to the world. We need to give to the world, and we also need to give everyone a reason to remember us. When you leave an interaction with somebody, give them a reason to think of you later. Whether it's in your engagement with that person,
mm-hmm.
or your ability to invoke a connection between you and that person, or your willingness to listen to what they have to say, mm-hmm. and to or your ability to share in the joys that somebody may be experiencing, or to support somebody in their sorrows, or whatever it may be. Give the world a reason to think about you later, and in doing so, you'll help build community.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about the story with Anger Cell Support Services?
Yeah, that's another story that comes to mind in chapter 10. This one really was a very touching story for me. I was asked by the ISSI in Ingersoll, the Ingersoll Support Services, if I would come and drum to the supported and the supporters. It was to help them relax. It was a new program they wanted to try. They had heard the benefits of drumming. So they were going to pay me, and I'm like, I don't need your money. I'm good. I'll just come do that for free.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the time, I was going through a divorce, and it was a very trying time in my life. So I remember going each week, and then one of the guys in the group, his name's Sean, he would walk past the Fusion Center where I was doing the drumming, and he'd come all the way to my store uptown, and then I'd drive him back. It was kind of a funny ritual that we did, but usually, you know, the trip back to the ISSI or the Fusion Center would include a stopover at Tim Hortons where we get a coffee and a bagel. So one day, Sean, I was going through my divorce, and I was really upset the one day. And then one day, Sean, he got in the car, and I'm just quiet. And I knew he could tell I was struggling. So he looks over at me, and I look over at him, actually, and I could see this look of panic or worry on his face. And I said, Sean, are you feeling what I'm feeling? And he says, yeah, are you okay? And I says, sorry, man, I'm going to knock this off. I'm going to cut it out. I'm just I was having a bad day, but, you know, that's nothing to do with you and I. So Sean's like, oh, okay, okay. And then we're just kind of quiet. And then he looks over at me, and he says, hey, I have an idea. And Sean says to me, he said, how about for today, I'll live in your heart and you can live in mine. And I started bawling, like right on the spot. Like, that was probably one of the most touching, loving gestures someone's ever said to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to give whatever he had in his being. He said, today I'll live in your heart and you can have mine. You can live inside of me. What a beautiful way to just surrender to another person, you know, and that if we could have those kind of interactions, our community would be a much different place.
Man.
Can you imagine a community that deeply and loved and cared for all its members? You know, if you're in trouble or things aren't well for you, that it radiates out in the community and everybody reaches out and holds you. Can you imagine how special that would be? And that's the kind of world that I imagine. That's the kind of world that could actually happen if we all got together and learned who we are. And my book isn't about programming somebody into and coming, convincing them into any of my beliefs. My book's about self-empowerment. And it's about people finding the truth of who they really are inside. And when you find that truth, your capacity and your willingness to love becomes second to none. And I believe that we can actually reach this when we deeply learn how to love.
Mm-hmm. And there's a quote in the book as well, is how you do one thing is how you do everything. And this sort of applies to perhaps people might hear that and they say, oh yeah, you know, like at work, or, you know, my relationship with my wife, anything like that. But I also feel too that when people become aware of your efforts and they see that you put so much devotion and effort into things and you give it 110%, that can also inspire community as well. So is there anything else that you could add to that quote that might drive that home a little more for us?
Well, I think if there's one thing I would want to close this session with, is that I challenge you to drop deeply into your soul and discover it for yourself. I challenge you to discover the depth of who and what you are, and share with me on social media or anywhere, any way you can contact me about how you've experienced unity.